Hello, everybody. Welcome back to yet another Science Studio program. This is Keith Pannell. And today we're going to be talking about all sorts of things to do with health and how do we correct the possible health disparities that are present in North America. Underrepresented minorities like Hispanics and African Americans maybe not get quite the health care that they deserve. And there are institutional reasons for this. Who studies this? Who is an authority on this? Well, it's certainly not Keith Pannell. But we're going to have Professor Margarita Echeverri from the College of Pharmacy at Xavier University. She is the Educational Coordinator in Health Disparities, Cultural Competence and Diversity. That is such a mouthful. But Margarita, welcome to Science Studio. Translate what I just said into English. What do you do at Xavier University?
Yeah, first of all, I am in the College of Pharmacy. But Xavier University has a mission that is help to have a more human and social community and humanity. So we have the center to reduce health disparities. But to reduce health disparities, we need to address many different factors. One of them is the culture, because we all have different cultures, different beliefs. We have different languages.
We all have the same health problems.
Exactly. But then we have the same problems, but we have different barriers to have our health.
So you just heard Margarita explain what I couldn't explain by the title. Now, before we get into what you actually do and why it's important, how you do it, and what results you've been able to obtain, tell us a little bit about Margarita. How on earth did you land up in this as a career?
Wow, that is a long story.
We've got 28 minutes, and then we can do another program on what you actually do.
I always said I have had several lives in this world, because in my previous life, I was a civil engineer.
Civil engineering?
Civil engineering.
Building bridges and roads and things like that.
Worse than that, dams.
Dams?
Electrical powerhouses.
Good Lord.
During 20 years.
Wow.
So in those projects, I have to go to the community and explain the neighborhoods or the areas that are going to be affected by the dams and the reservoirs.
Quite often drowned by the dams,
Lots of impact, ecological and social impact. So I had to explain the community why we are doing that, how we do that, what benefits they're going to get. And reduce the impact in the community. So when that I was doing that, I was realizing that engineering was not the way, because I have a lot of challenges. I had to bring all the engineers to the area and talk to the campesinos, and they didn't know how to talk to them. So I began
because they had no experience of the lifestyle and the pattern of the social behavior of the people that were being impacted.
Exactly.
Because it's never rich people that get their house drowned out by a new dam, right?
It's always the
people on the fringes.
Exactly. It's more like the campesinos, because it's rural areas.
Right.
So they have very difficult times explaining the community, and I told them, it doesn't matter if you build the most powerful electrical house or engineering construction or work, if you cannot explain that in plain language to a community member. Like, what is a dam?
And this was in Colombia.
That was in Colombia, in my country. So in that time in Colombia, there was a master that was social management. So I got that master degree. I like it very much, but I didn't learn all what I wanted. So I came to United States. I was very fortunate to get a scholarship for a master and later for a PhD. And I changed from my engineering background to social sciences, like public health.
Let's go back, though. I'm sort of intrigued by this business of building dams, because all rivers around the world of any magnitude seem to, somebody, usually an engineer, wants to put a dam in. And then they will say, well, it's going to be for hydroelectric power, or sometimes, if you're really lucky, on the one extreme, to create lakes that can be used by, large numbers of the population for recreation. But no one ever goes to one of these lakes and thinks, well, what's about 200 feet down until the drought comes. And then you suddenly see buildings, old buildings rising out of the lake. And how did you deal with that in your own mind when you were in Colombia, seeing that the people on the fringes of society that were being impacted in that negative way?
Yeah, but we have to be like have a balance, okay? There are negative impacts, but there are positive impacts. And this is what we do. We do the social impact and economic impact and the ecological impact of the projects. And all of them have to have, at the end, more benefits than harm. So this is what we, at the end, build the projects. Sometimes we have to reduce the size of the projects to decrease the impact. But usually in the community, at the long way, there is a positive impact because the reservoir, like you said, the project, many times the lakes can be used for flood control. And you use that a lot for water supply, also for fishing recreation. And so it brings a lot of economical development to the area. And you are right. Sometimes we flood little communities and the buildings are under the water.
Right. Yes. So I'm trying to think then that compensation for people whose land is confiscated and whose land is flooded. In Colombia, did they have a very good methodology for making sure that the people displaced were given an equivalent location and the government helped provide new homes and villages for them if necessary?
We go farther, and this was my job in Colombia. Once I finished my master, I became the director of the community outreach and the social impact of the projects. So we had to relocate the community, of course, but they are the ones who decide where they want to be relocated. They are the ones who design the new city, the churches, the houses, the cemeteries, the schools, the hospitals. We sit with the community and we work together.
So you've actually been able to take a relatively large, I mean, you mentioned hospitals and churches. And so these weren't tiny little hamlets. These were little towns.
Originally, they are little towns, rural areas that sometimes they don't have a school, they don't have a hospital. But as part of the impact that we want to create in that community, we build the hospital, we build the clinic, and we give them their new houses that have the water, electricity, all the services that they didn't have before. So it's a whole new community, and they have also, we educate them to handle the impact of the tourists because a reservoir always brings people that want to do other activities. So they became business managers, and that is a negative impact because sometimes they are campesinos that are building the crops and are in the agriculture, and they became more small business managers. But we always handle all the impact, and we divide like the jobs to do, and we bring new professors and
school. That sounds like a very sophisticated and I must say far-reachingly beautiful way to relocate people. But that's the idea from someone who doesn't live there. Did you still get resistance to movement, even though the new little townships with facilities they didn't have before would be available?
Most of the resistance is for people that have been for generations in the same house.
Yes.
So they don't want their house to be destroyed. So sometimes we build exactly the same house, but in another place and better constructions. So they keep their memories. But the other big resistance is when the cemetery is going to be flooded. Because they don't want their loved family members being underwater. So we had to relocate the cemetery also.
So the church must get involved in this then to give its blessing to... How does that work?
Everybody is involved because everybody is affected. So we work with the political people, we work with the church, we work with the leaders. There are projects that have been built in areas when we have a lot of violence, like the guerrilla, for example. So we invite the guerrilla to the table also as community members.
Well, that's interesting. So, I mean, did you find, I mean, there's an organization called the FARC. I know it's no longer supposed to be in existence, but to cause trouble, did they then sometimes go to the people that were going to be displaced and sort of feed them lines to say, well, you know, it's your government doing nasty things, but if you joined our group, we'd be much more sympathetic?
No, they usually, because I was in that time working in those projects, they sent me a cordial invitation to meet with them.
Okay.
And I always told them, we have community meetings. You are members of the community. You are welcome to attend the community meetings. And you are welcome to talk and say. Initially, they didn't like it so much because usually when you are building these projects, you have security. Yes. But we negotiate. So sometimes I am in the road and I pass the police security. And 1 mile later, I had the guerrilla security, and I had my ID the guerrilla gave me to as a worker in the area. So it's always a conversation, a negotiation for the good of everybody.
And so, I mean, by virtue of your job, working with the Campesino community and working for the government putting in dams, you sort of had a bit of an immunity on both sides. You never worried for being kidnapped, for example, or anything like that?
My man was very worried. She was telling my husband, oh, you should not let her go to that area. It's so dangerous. And my husband always laughed and said, do not worry, Doña Nubia. If they kidnap Margarita, I'm sure one day later they're going to call me and say, how much money you want to receive her back?
Did you negotiate this at all with your husband?
I am a good negotiator.
Wow, what a wonderful background of interesting. And I'm sort of almost surprised that you chose to carry on and get a PhD when you had such an interesting and useful career. But we'll come back and discuss that in a moment. You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. I'm here today with Margarita Echeverri, and she is from Xavier University School of Pharmacy, and we'll be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog.
And I'm Dr. David Niesel. Just when we thought things couldn't get crazier, there's a movement against tap water that promotes raw water, which is untreated, unfiltered water.
This reminds me of the anti-vaccine movement because it suggests tap water is toxic. They argue that this so-called raw water is better for you because it's devoid of chlorine, fluoride, and contains probiotics that improve gut flora.
These people can afford to bash tap water because we all take it for granted that the U.S. has among the safest tap water in the world, even with the occasional lapse such as in Flint, Michigan.
Before water is treated, it can be contaminated with bacteria, viruses, parasites, or algae. Even the most isolated mountain stream or spring can contain parasites that can make you very ill.
Yet the raw water proponents are spreading dangerous misinformation in their zeal to pursue what they believe is a healthier option. One zealot claims the fact that his raw water turns green in a month is a sign that it's alive and better for you.
One California company sells their untreated spring water for $36.99 for a 2.5-gallon jug. Of course, not all raw water is dangerous, since people in the U.S. use well water or collect rainwater, and both are untreated. But they should be tested.
Well water can contain heavy metals and radioactive elements from the soil and underlying rocks, as well as nitrates and nitrites from fertilizers. Industrial contaminants and illegal dumping can also affect the safety of wells and spring water.
Bottled spring waters in stores are regulated by the government, so they're not like the raw water being touted by this movement. I say, drink at your own risk.
We are Drs. David Niesel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discovery shaped the future of medicine. For much more and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Margarita Echeverri from Xavier University School of Pharmacy. And we were just sort of going through the history, which is fascinating. A dam builder going into social work, trying to explain the benefits of dam building to the people being displaced. A very delicate task, I can imagine, having to deal with the government. What a career that was. But you changed it all. You came to the U.S., got a PhD, And now you're really interested and active in what I will call health disparity, for want of a better expression. Tell the audience, what does that really mean?
Yeah, when I was again in my doing my PhD, is in social sciences. So what I said, okay, let's focus in three main foundations of social and national development: health, education, and technology. So my PhD is interdisciplinary studies when I put in together these three pillars. And this is why, for example, I was in the University of Maryland and I was the director of the Master in Information Management, that is technology, okay? But now I am more working in the academics, that is education. So this is now I am working in universities instead of the private or government sectors. And the focus is health, because if you have people that are healthy, educated, and have access to computers and technology, those people can do whatever they want
more
in their lives.
That's right.
So that is my objective. So when I was doing my PhD, I wanted to address those disparities that people have. Disparities in access to education, disparities in access to health, and also disparities in access to technology. Because it's a big, big debate that we have today. How this?
That's the first time I've sort of put down the acronym HET, Health, Education, and Technology. I'm so used to STEM, right, that here's another one, and that's same idea, really, but just with a different emphasis. Tell me about the big problems that you deal with then. You're at Xavier University. This is in New Orleans, and so that's Louisiana. You have a large community of African-American students in an African-American community, and you've come from Colombia. What are the similarities? When you say, oh, I did this in Colombia, all right, now I'm doing this in New Orleans, what's different and what's similar?
It's so interesting because different is first the system, the country. Definitely our health system in our countries, Latino countries, is totally different than the health system here. And I teach my students about that. You have to be aware when you are working with a patient that is from a Latino immigrant, because we have totally different system and we expect different things from our doctors. But the differences in culture is not so much. I am fascinated every day because when I talk about cultural competency, it's our doctors, our nurses, our physicians and pharmacists, all healthcare providers are aware on how to work with patients that belong to a different cultural background. And I expected a lot of differences between the Latino culture and the African American. And there are more similarities than differences. It's amazing. We love music. We love food. We are noisy.
Yes. Sorry.
It's true. Yes. And we are family oriented. We love hugging and kissing. It's the same. There is no difference.
I mean, that's an issue which I was surprised at. Coming from England, you know, there's a tendency not to go hug and kiss people. But here it's sort of taken, you know, between men and women. I mean, my students sometimes come up and give me a hug. You know, now in other parts of the country, that would be anathema. You know, you can't go up and hug a student, all right? But here it's part of that culture, and it's quite healthy and normal.
Yeah, but believe me, a hug sometimes make more positive effect in health than a medication.
That's interesting.
Believe me.
Because you're saying that the psychology of your day-to-day activity, how you feel comfortable, how you feel treasured, right? And that may be not the correct word, but how you feel appreciated. These are important things for day-to-day health.
Yes, exactly. And for the Latinos, it's very important. Yes. So, for example, now I work a lot with cancer prevention, cancer screening in the Latino and in the African American communities. And I tell them, yes, what is the first thing we do when we know we have cancer? And we both, the first way we do is we go to church. We pray.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So you cannot separate the physical aspects of the diseases from the mental condition and the spirituality.
So,
and this is what I teach.
That's interesting
about.
Because as then somebody who's trying to spread the word, if you like, on what's available in the health services, do you work through the churches?
Yes. My university is an African-American majority university, and it's Catholic. It's the only one in the country, Catholic and majority black university. And this is one of the reasons I am in that university, because I am Catholic. I really believe that you cannot separate sciences from spirituality. So our philosophy is that we have to educate our students in all the areas. So we have a moral obligation to help the other, regardless of who the other is. And we have the moral obligation also as a healthcare providers to communicate with the patients in a real and sensitive way.
Right.
And this is what we call cultural competency.
Yeah, that's interesting because I travel in Mexico quite a lot. And it's always interesting for me to go to churches because they're beautiful buildings and there's a tremendous peace inside them, even though I'm not a believer. But one always sees these images of Jesus and Mary, and they look like me. I mean, you know, they're white. Okay. Now, how does that go down in a African-American Catholic society? Do you have images in Xavier where it's clear that
the black,
Jesus isn't just
we have
a
the
white
black
Anglo-Saxon?
Jesus. We
right.
had the black Jesus in right. our church.
Yeah.
Our university was founded by a nun that now is a saint. So we have a chapel in the middle of the university, and we have the Jesus that is black. There is the black Virgin Mary.
Right.
Yes, because at the end, yes, doesn't matter the color of the skin. The important is the feeling, the message.
Well, that's
that
the 21st century, but the 18th century and the 19th century, Jesus had to be, I'm sure, all over the world when the Catholic missionaries went out
with
there.
With blue eyes
just,
and
oh,
blue
absolutely. Just more English than the English. I mean, I don't have blue eyes. I mean, that's fascinating. Do you have many discussions like this with the students?
Although our university is Catholic, the majority of our faculty and students are not Catholic.
Oh, okay.
So we have interfaith services in the chapel. We have a lot of Muslim people, and we have also Baptists students, African Americans, most of them are Baptists. Because we have an idea is that regardless of what your religion you have, anywhere there is the same moral obligation. There are the same ethical principles. Okay?
Yes.
It's not doubt on that. I always tell the students, all religions have a God. Doesn't matter how you describe that God. Okay? All religions pray. Doesn't matter what kind of prayer you have. Mm-hmm. All are pray. We all want to be healthy. We all want to be good people. So
and we all want to do something
useful
in our society.
So right. This is what I always say. We have to build in our commonalities, what is common between us, but also get the strength in our differences because this is what enriches the community also.
So here you are, an engineer that built dams, displaced people, explained why they were being displaced, come to America, and now you're working in a sort of health disparity area and have to communicate with the people outside of the academic world. What's the biggest problem now facing health provision in America from your perspective? What's the biggest issue that you have to deal with?
Remember my previous life. In my previous life, I was building dams, and I think in this new life, I am destroying dams. Because this is what we have to do. That is the big problem we have, is those barriers that we build among ourselves. We believe that we are the perfect ones and the wrongs are the others. So we are creating a lot of barriers. I know there are a lot of situations, like, for example, access to healthcare. It's not fair that some people have so very good health insurances and others do not have health insurance or health insurance do not cover all their needs. those facts are because of people, because the ones who create the policies are people. And as I said, the policy makers are also community members, because they also buy groceries, they go to the parks, they belong to a community. So sometimes we build those dams around ourselves, our jobs, and we need to destroy those and open.
Well, one of the dams, as you put it, we had a student here who went down to work in the Sierra down here in Chihuahua with the Tarahumara Indians. And she said that she would very rarely see a man. The male of this indigenous group were very reticent to see a doctor. The women would be much more likely to come. Do you see that in an African-American setting that you're in? That the
yes.
males are much less likely to go to get medical help than the females? And is that one of the dams you've got to sort of cut through?
Exactly. And just yesterday, we were here working with a group of 40 Latino women that are promotoras de salud. We were working with them yesterday and seeing what is our role in the family and also in healthcare. Because we are the ones who bring the husbands and dads and uncles to the doctors, and the children also to the doctors. So we play a very important role. And we were talking that there are some of these women, the husbands do not allow them to go to the doctor.
Really?
Because the husband do not want the doctor touching the wives.
Well, that's right.
Can you believe that?
So I mean, would they be okay if it was a female doctor?
These are the barriers we have to destroy. So
right.
We need more female doctors, because right now in the demographics of the country, there are more women than men. But the doctors are more male than female doctors.
Yeah.
So if we want, as a woman, I want a female doctor, but there are not enough. So what I had to do, I need my care anyway. So close the eyes and have your male doctor, because in what way you're not going to have care.
I mean, that's interesting, because one reads about going to see a doctor where you actually don't ever see a doctor because you're in a rural area. And so there could be video interactions, right, where you're clearly not being touched by anybody. But then they'll sooner or later have robotic doctors, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they'll have to have robots with female voices and robots with male voices. I mean, you can just see the development of so many different areas of society.
And we go back to the connection between health, education, and technology.
Right.
And this is where I teach also in the university about electronic health records and telehealth, telemedicine, because there are many, many new options now to get care. Of course, sometimes we need to be physically with the doctor and they touch us and look at when they
right.
are doing, for example, a breast exam. Okay, they need to touch us.
Right. Mm. One of my cousins is an MD in Toronto, but every Christmas she vanishes up into the North Pole in the dark and treats the indigenous people, the Inuit up there. And she said it's just wonderful because they're so happy to have someone that will go up there and spend this period of time.
And that is very important for the Latino community and also African-American community. We need a personal contact.
Do you have what I might call a group of doctors that will actually go as far as doing house visits? Because that's another issue with certain communities, that the inability to get to a doctor. And is there a movement to have doctors go to the
there is now what we call
them?
The home clinics. And it's so interesting because that is a new concept in the United States. But that is what we have in our Latino countries. We have a little clinic in a garage in every corner of the neighborhood. But
you also have curanderos and your
curanderos,
right?
Yeah.
And you have pharmacists who actually almost work like MDs. You know, they begin to say, oh, my dear, you've got this problem on your arm. I think I can provide you this, that, and the other.
Exactly. We go first to the pharmacist than to the doctor.
Right, yes.
And if the pharmacist said you have to go to the doctor, okay. But usually they are the ones who touch if we have the fever and they send us the antibiotics or whatever.
That is
what we are trying to do here in the United States now, is the home clinics. when people, instead of going to the hospitals, they stay at home. Because it's much better to be sick at home with the caring of your family and in your own bed than being in a hospital.
As long as you're getting good advice and good treatment.
Exactly.
If you're not, then I don't think it's probably a good idea.
And there are some treatments that definitely you have to go to the hospital. So it's a balance.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we've balanced out our 28 minutes, Margarita. It's been a lot of fun. We've been talking with Margarita Echeverri, and she is from the School of Pharmacy at Xavier University in New Orleans. Medical outreach, but she was a dam builder, and she's still now destroying dams. That is this barrier between most people that we are talking about getting medical treatment and not getting it. Fascinating program. Margarita, thank you so much for being here.
No, thanks very much for the invitation. It's really a pleasure.
And I'm obviously going to thank Lauren Terrazas for putting this program together. And we thank you out there for listening. And we'll be back next week with yet another Science Studio. Bye-bye.